And now, ladies and gentlemen, on QSO, our special guest, Glenn Houser, the originator and producer of World of Radio. You want to check out his website at worldofradio.com. Our guest is Glenn Houser, and this is an interview that I've wanted to do. I've wanted to have Glenn on the show for a long, long time, and we've just schedules are what they are, I guess. But welcome aboard, and I want to just ask a question, and that is, when did World of Radio get started?
Well, Ted, thanks a lot for inviting me. Glad to be with you. I started it in Knoxville, Tennessee, when I was working for a public radio station. This would have been in the late 1970s or early 80s, and a bit later it appeared on shortwave, so more people knew about it.
Now, when you started this in Knoxville, was this was just on a local station?
Yes.
What? I'm just curious. What is your background, say, in broadcast radio? You've been in the radio business yourself for some time, but I mean, I you know, and I hear rumblings. You know, Glenn, you're kind of like a one of these number stations. You're a little mysterious. It's the voice that's on the air all the time, but you never know anything about this guy. did you get started in radio as an announcer, or how did you get into that?
Yes, with mainly in news and then in announcing classical music. I was in the broadcast, especially when I was in the Air Force for 4 years, from 68 to 72. However, before I went in, I was already working for a classical music station in Albuquerque, and I did some hometown highlights, I believe they called it, local news summaries that I sent in to AFRTS. I believe that you could say that was my first involvement in broadcast radio. And then after I became a civilian again, I worked at several public radio stations, the main one being WUOT in Knoxville for several years.
So you developed an interest in radio and had an interest also in classical music early on.
Oh, yes.
Do you have any musical background whatsoever?
Oh, I had some piano lessons, so I can sort of play the piano, but I'm not really a performer. But I really love classical music, also very interested in languages, so those really tied in well together.
You know, I've loved classical. When I worked in Detroit as a very, very young fellow, I worked at WQRS. I don't know if you've ever heard of the station.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I love listening to classical music. The problem about playing it on the radio is pronouncing all the names. You can really make an idiot of yourself trying to announce some of those names. And, of course, if you've got a language background, you probably understand a lot of the pronunciation. And I guess once you're into it, it's not nearly as strange as it seems when you're first looking at it.
No, not at all. Each language, unlike English, most languages, I should say, have their own phonetic scheme, and all you have to do is learn the scheme, and you'll know how to pronounce most of the words, even if you don't understand them.
Your interest in shortwave radio, and radio period, I guess I should say, because the radio program covers just about every aspect of broadcasting at times. You mentioned just about anything in there that comes down that's something current. What was your very first exposure to shortwave?
That would be back in Santa Rosa, New Mexico, the town where I spent my first 8 or 9 years. The family had an old Philco console radio with shortwave bands on it. So although at that time I was mainly interested in tuning around medium wave, couldn't help but notice the odd sounds and strange places I was hearing on shortwave. So that was the first shortwave I heard.
When you flipped from the broadcast band and onto shortwave, what were some of the first things you remember hearing?
Strangely enough, what comes to mind is some kind of multiplex noise. You know, nothing intelligible, but loud signals making a grinding sound. No, they're not jamming, but some kind of utility. But I also heard the broadcast stations. Radio Australia was one of the regulars in the mornings here, as I'm sure it was for many others. A few years later, I moved to Oklahoma with my family and got my first real shortwave radio, Hallicrafters S38E, and really got into shortwave listening.
Well, you know, I can recall having an old Gruno that my dad had. That's odd. This is an odd story, but nonetheless, this thing, I just remember tuning around, and you could hear these things on the air that just sounded like sound like an airplane engine or something, just running, just a constant hum. You know, not a hum. I don't really know what I'm looking for. It's like a grinding sound. Then it would just go on.
Your description sounds pretty much like what I was trying to describe.
And I wondered what they were located in various places on the dial. Then you'd hear other things that sound like a horse galloping or something. It just, you know, I don't know if you ever heard those, but they just a constant galloping sound, you know. But as a young person, I never heard any number stations. Do you remember the first time you ever heard a number station?
Not really, although I think that did come quite a bit later.
Well, a lot of mysterious sounds on a shortwave radio. And, of course, back then, the rig I had didn't have any BFO on it, so it was all AM. So anything that came across was being modulated that way. But, you know, you've got such an intense interest in it, and I wondered, you know, when you first got started as a kid, what caught your eye about radio? Was there something that you remember that just kind of grabbed you and got your attention?
I guess it was the fascination of hearing faraway places and different languages. This is all kind of synergistic. It got me interested in learning foreign languages, studying them at school, so I could understand more of what I was hearing. And I should say I was also into TV DXing early on, since we didn't have any local stations out in that remote town, and we're trying to pick up Albuquerque, and instead we were getting TV skip off and on from much further away.
Did you have very many friends that were interested in the same thing? Could you share this with very many people?
No. In fact, I can't think of any.
Well, the reason
as a child.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I went through that stage where I had this intense interest, but there was all the rest of my friends. I had a lot of friends, and we did a lot of different things together, but when it came down to the radio stuff, they kind of gave me some weird looks and want to go off and play ball somewhere or something. So I've kind of wondered that. It'd been nice to have a childhood where you had a whole bunch of folks that were interested in the same thing. In putting together World of Radio, one wonders, I mean, when I hear the amount of information that you put out during one broadcast, it absolutely amazes me. Now, was it like that at first, or did you, how did you have that much information right off the bat, or did it take take time to accumulate the contacts and all the things that you have in order to put such a concise program together?
Oh, sure. It's built up constantly over the years as I've developed more and more sources. But I can't say I ever had a problem filling out the time. There's always interesting info to talk about. In fact, it's rather frustrating now that I don't have enough time to really get into a single subject at much depth.
Well, I've noticed, I've noticed that the ham community, as I talk to different ones, there's a lot of guys that are not really familiar with World of Radio. I ask them, and I'm so surprised, some of these fellows have been in it for years. But I guess there's a big distinction, really, maybe a larger gulf between shortwave listeners and hams than what a lot of folks realize. I mean, I know they're related and they're close together in a lot of respects, but do you find that too? Do you find that there's some distance there?
Yeah, I guess there must be. Obviously, the hams are mainly interested in communicating with each other on the certain frequencies, and shortwave listeners are mainly interested in hearing broadcast stations, although there can be overlap, but there's really quite different approaches to radio.
Do you ever listen to hams much at all, or do you ever try to DX any hams, or just listen to the conversations?
Oh yeah, I do off and on. Early on, when back in the solar peak of 57, 58, I was hearing stuff from all over on 10 meters, and that was really fun. Got a few ham QSLs from what seemed like rare countries, like Laos, and I still tune across the ham bands, sometimes stop if I hear something interesting.
Well, I was going to say, because it's interesting, because I've gotten, just being on the radio, just shooting the breeze with somebody, you know, and not really having any kind of a serious conversation. The next thing I know, I've got a postcard from a shortwave listener and wanting me to send them a QSL card. And I thought that just seemed, I wondered how much of that went on. I've had probably 10 of those that I can recall over my stay in ham radio. And there's folks, I know guys out there that's got a lot more than that. A good portion of them, or a lot of them, used to operate a lot of AM, and I think that may, I don't know if that tends to attract more or not. Well, what about, let me ask you this question, what about sideband broadcasting on shortwave? Now, I hear some stations talk about reduced carrier, and some use sideband. Is that fairly common for as broadcast is concerned?
No, not at all. Just a few stations are doing it, I think, notably WBCQ, but a few years ago, of course, it was thought this might be the wave of the future to make better use of spectrum, but it really didn't catch on, and now they're trying to promote DRM, which is sort of in the other direction.
Well, I wondered about that, because I found, you know, like, for example, on WBCQ, we were on 9330 there for a pretty good while. Station had a good signal. But anytime you played any music, it was a little strange trying to tune it in. Now, that was probably just my receiver. Can you take a sideband station, say, for example, on a receiver that you're using, and actually get a decent, I guess I want to say a decent amount of audio or clean-sounding audio if they're playing music and they're operating with reduced carrier?
It's very, very touchy. For instance, I have an ATS-909 or a DX-398, which tunes in 40 hertz steps. So if it happens to fall on right on one of those steps, then you should get a good demodulation of music. But if not, you can't really tune in between there. And then I'm also still using an old FRG-7 analog tuning. And, of course, that's continuous. So once it settles down and isn't drifting, if you're very, very careful on the big knob, you can get the music sounding just about right. But it is very touchy.
You know, I know you're a lover of classical music. Do you hear much classical being played on shortwave?
Not much, but when I do, I really make note of it. There are a few stations that do have regular classical music programs, notably Radio Japan. They have at least an hour every week in their Japanese service, but, of course, it doesn't matter that much if you're just listening for the music.
Well, I was going to say, because even with just about any type of music on shortwave, it's almost like an acquired taste. You know, I mean, it's like I find myself with medium wave or broadcast radio, or AM. I'm very comfortable listening to an AM station and listening to music on AM. And matter of fact, I prefer to hear oldies on an AM station because I grew up with that. It just sounds more authentic to me. However, I have two sons, and they can't figure out what my problem is. So I enjoy listening to things on shortwave, especially music, because to me it has a characteristic to it, something different. Folks might refer to it as diminished quality, but there's I don't know, there's just something about it. It's the well, what is it? Is it the phasing that we're hearing and the...
The selective fading, which causes the distortion to come and go. I can see how people who are not experienced with that would find it distracting or even a turnoff, but that's something a taste I acquired, I guess, long ago, or at least it didn't bother me. And, you know, when that fading occurs on shortwave, just sort of let it go by and ignore it, and it makes you realize even more that the signal is coming from far away, which somehow adds something.
Well, you know, I don't think it's too much different from AM listening, because when I was younger, I lived in the Detroit area, and I would listen to WLS out of Chicago and WABC out of New York, and they would just simply drop out of sight for a few seconds, and then they'd come right back. So they'd be right in the middle of a song, and they'd drop out, they'd come back, and you just didn't give it any thought. I mean, it was just part of the way it was, you know, and there was part of the mystique behind it. And I think now of going to sleep at night with a transistor in bed with me or under my pillow or something like that, and the station's coming and, you know, fading in and fading out. And, of course, you'd wake up in the morning and there'd be nothing there but static because the sun was up, you know. But I think that's something folks are missing out on. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a little deranged. But don't you find that magical, though? I mean, when you hear a station coming in and it starts rolling in and out, it just... It's just something special about that.
Yes, indeed. Of course, the medium wave band is so crowded these days that it's very difficult to hear anything without interference. And a lot of the fading is caused by stations being on not exactly the same frequency, not really propagational fading. So that makes it a bit more of a chore to listen to AM these days, as it's really a local signal.
Well, what do you think the future of DRM is? Do you think DRM has a future, or do you think that we're trying to apply a technology where it maybe can't be applied? What's your thinking on that?
Well, they sure are trying. They've been trying for 10 years, and it really hasn't caught on. It's still hard to find a receiver. You know, if you go the computer route, get a program that'll decode it, you can do that, but you're out of luck if you want to go to a store and buy a DRM receiver, except maybe a very specialized store, and maybe if they finally get their act together. Now, I really don't see it going anywhere, but it has still has this organization trying to push it, and if they can convince broadcasters to try it, more and more broadcasters to try it, there may be some applications for it. It seems like India is going for it, at least for domestic broadcasting, if not some of their external broadcasting, too. But they really have a PR problem because they've insisted on running the DRM noise inside the regular AM shortwave bands, and that really drives away people who are trying to listen to AM without the interference.
Well, I haven't followed DRM that much. Have you listened to it? Have you actually heard a DRM station on the receive end at all?
Only very briefly at a conference. This is your main chance to try it, apparently. They appear at, I know they appeared at NAB recently and other gatherings of broadcasters to demonstrate it. But I can't say I've had any chance to really sit down and listen for any length of time. Of course, I could if I really wanted to, but I have plenty to listen to that's not DRM, and if I want to hear something that goes through a computer, I can listen on my computer to many more stations that I could possibly get on DRM.
Well, you know, I guess I tried it. I got one of the programs and connected it to the receiver, and I never could get it to operate. I mean, I thought I had something for a few brief seconds, but then it... It wouldn't sync or lock up right for me, you know, so it would, I don't know if the receiver's passband was too narrow. I don't really know what it was, but I couldn't get it to work. Now, I've had other folks that I've talked to, and they basically tell me the same thing. They say, I've tried this, but I can't get it to work. But now, there are folks that are out there broadcasting in DRM right now, are there not?
Oh, yeah, there is quite a schedule. There are websites that list all the current transmissions. I think apparently it requires a pretty strong signal to have any chance of decoding, and that isn't always the case unless you're in just the right place or just the right angle from the transmitter.
Well, I know it was difficult for me, but, you know, once again, it might come real easy for somebody else, you know, that don't really knows what they're doing. I was just kind of anxious. I wanted to see what it sounded like, you know, and... I just wasn't very successful with it. Where do you think right now? Now, I've had a couple of conversations with these folks over in China called the Texon Radio Company. I don't know if you're familiar with them at all. I don't know a lot about them, but I have got a contact over there, and I talk to them back and forth. They manufacture just some unbelievable amount of shortwave radios. And, of course, they make Eton. I don't know if they make all of them, but they make a lot of the Etons. They make a lot of the Grundigs and whatnot. And they're telling me that there's a sharp rise at this point in radio purchases, shortwave radio purchases. Where do you think it's going? I mean, some of the governments have abandoned broadcasting. They say it's a dead horse and all this kind of thing. We never suffer from email. I can tell you that. There's a lot of people listening. So where do you see it going at this point?
Well, I guess one should ask them where they see it going. They must know where the sales are. I wonder if they're talking about third world or in the rest of the world, because as far as we know, the shortwave, interest in shortwave listening isn't really growing in the developed world.
Well, now, they sell an awful lot. I guess they private label many of the radios that are sold at Radio Shack. And I went up on Radio Shack's website, and I think I come up with like 29 receivers, of which I think about 10 of them were shortwave, were included at least, you know, one or two of the shortwave bands. Probably five or six of them were digital readouts, and I don't know how good a quality they are. But in talking to the folks at Radio Shack, they say, well, if the items don't sell here, we discontinue them. You know, so that you can't, don't go into a Radio Shack looking for a phono cartridge. You will not find it. They're not there. But, you know, you used to be able to get little replacement styluses for your Shure cartridges and whatnot, or the Stantons that a lot of the DJs use. You can't find them. They're not there anymore. So they would drop, I know they dropped amateur items, but they still stock quite a bit. A line of shortwaves. I know just the one store here, they've got five different models in there. So I guess that's what I'm wondering. I wonder if we have an accurate feel for this as far as distribution, sales, and of course, some of those radios have AM and FM on them, but...
I was going to say probably a lot of those are shortwave is sort of an add-on or a value-added feature, you know, they can use in promoting it. But it's not; they're not strictly shortwave radios.
Well, I know there's two or three of them that have BFOs on them. Well, I say BFO. I don't know what the circuit is that they have the equivalent of, but you can hear, you can tune sideband. And I was just impressed by the fact. I talked to one of the salesmen at a couple of the Radio Shack stores, and I talked to one of their people who was with Radio Shack management, and he indicated to me they move an awful lot of shortwave radios, and people want come in specifically and asking for them. But I didn't know if you'd had a feel for that. I mean, I don't know. From what I can see, either there's just a whole boatload of listeners out there that have not diminished, or possibly there is a increase in interest, and I would think you would have a feel for that, being doing this as long as you have.
Well, I'm afraid I guess I don't, not being in the marketing end. I can't contradict what the people at Radio Shack say, and I'm glad to hear that if they really are selling a lot of shortwave radios. I guess there's always new blood coming along, and there, of course, there are these survivalist people who feel they need that for perhaps not the best of reasons.
The thing I guess is With what's happening in broadcasting today, you know, and I wonder if this might be a clue as to if there is an increase. You know, here I go. This is my soapbox here. I find most broadcast radio stations, FM primarily, that are in the music format, are just mundane to listen to. I just am bored to tears, you know. And I've got a background in this business. I mean, I've worked some places, and you know, I worked under Bill Drake and all that. And I don't know. I'm just bored to tears tuning in, listening to these things. Now, talk radio is a different story. But the problem with talk radio is there's so many different political alignments. You know, unless you're really flexible in your attitude, depending on who you tune into, you know. But it doesn't seem like there's a lot of just entertainment, you know, just something interesting. Most markets are starving for good classical music stations. You'll find maybe one public radio station in a town, but you hardly see any commercial classical music stations. The WQRS in Detroit was one. But it was interesting, while working there, I had a chance to meet and talk to some of the clients, and the clients swore by the station. I mean, these people were on the air with WQRS for the long haul, and they wouldn't dream of dropping their ads because they claim it brought people in through the door. So I wonder why that is. I know I'm just asking a question, like, but does it make any sense, though, that you go into a major market and you don't have, you know, a really good solid commercial classical music station, or possibly two? I mean, it seems like there's room for that.
Well, I would like to think so, but I guess the demographics don't bear that out. At least the people who own stations, they want to do whatever format is most profitable. Of course, the argument can be made that your classical music listeners are likely to be high-end or higher income, but they're also likely to be older. And you know how marketing, for some reason, always skews toward the younger.
Oh, that is true. I think what you're saying about being a higher end type audience, I think that's the case. You know, at least that's what I was able to see. These are people who research something before they make a purchase, and then there's a certain amount of loyalty there that I think that you don't see, you know, with another audience. Well, going down that road, the satellite services, XM and Sirius. I purchased an XM receiver. Actually, I had one given to me for my birthday. And, you know, I unpacked the thing, and it was about the size of a pack of cigarettes. I said, "This is not a radio. I'm sorry. This is, I don't know what this is, but it's not a radio." And I got hooked listening to the thing because they had such extensive playlists. They had live disc jockeys on the air. And one fellow who's a friend of mine was doing one of the channels at XM in Washington, D.C. He was living there. But then it seems like they just took a dive and went into, I don't know what it is. I've canceled my subscriptions on the things. I think they're just, you know, I'm just bored with them. So I'm back to my shortwave radio, and I've got a Zune, which is the equivalent to the iPod. And, of course, I listen to World of Radio on my Zune and and other things. But it's just, I'm wondering if that couldn't fuel more people grabbing a radio and flipping it onto the shortwave bands and tuning and saying, what else can I find here? That makes sense to me. Does it make sense to you?
You mean as a replacement for satellite?
Well, as a replacement for anything. In other words, just out of, you know, looking for something. You know, I mean, it's like, I'm not finding what I want. Let me look somewhere else. And being that shortwave is somewhere they've probably never looked before.
Oh, yeah. That's part of the fascination of shortwave. You're always discovering new things, new languages, new countries, new programs. And furthermore, you can't always hear the same thing the next night at the same time.
Now, a lot of folks would find that frustrating, of course. But that's part of the excitement of it. I know when we're on the air and WBCQ is the atmosphere has changed, and I'm sitting here and I can't even detect a carrier. It gets very frustrating, but then I have to realize that somewhere, someplace, you know, the show is going on. And well, what fascinates you the most? What do you, when you're doing DXing yourself? You know, you're just doing it for your own enjoyment. What are you generally looking for?
Something out of the ordinary, which usually comes down to a station doing something wrong, making a mistake. You know, a modulation problem, putting out a spur, or a new frequency. That isn't exactly wrong, but it's something that needs to be uncovered.
Do you get? I mean, I guess I want to say, do you get reports of that also from other folks that are monitoring, that they tune in and happen on something like this, and then they let you know about it.
Oh, sure. Well, I apply the usual criteria for news judgment in this particular field. If it's something that's there all the time, that's already known, it's not really news unless someone has an interesting observation about the programming.
Well, I know a couple of times, I've read in your, and I read and I listen both, but, I've read where you were mentioning that there was, a station having a mixed problem or two stations having a mixed problem or a station having a harmonic problem or that sort of thing. So is that something that's easy to notice? Do you just get used to what's on the bands and you know what should or should not be there? Or does it require some careful scanning around and to find these things?
Well, I'm always running across them, and yes, I am pretty familiar with the bands, so that makes it makes them stand out. Of course, I can always research the scheduling later if I'm not sure about something and see whether it is already known.
Who are the, I guess I want to say, of the foreign countries that are on the air, would you say that there are any, as we might call them, ill-mannered shortwave broadcasters that cause problems on the bands?
Oh, yes. There are the countries which jam. Of course, they would tell you that the jamming is separate from the broadcasting, but that isn't really true. For example, in the case of China, where it's all integrated into one government agency, that's the worst thing. Countries which jam other countries and also cause collateral damage. And then there are countries which are so, or stations which are so incompetent, they can't even broadcast correctly. They're barely modulated, or they're distorted modulated, or they put out a big buzz like Saudi Arabia on one of their transmitters, which means no one can hear what they're saying, but yet they keep transmitting it.
Yeah, I recall tuning a station in like that one time. It had the I thought they'd lost the filter cap in their power supply or something. It was really bad, and it just continued night after night after night. But it's been some time ago, and I wondered about that. So I guess they what is it? Do you think that is it they don't realize what they're doing, or what would cause that?
Well, it's hard to imagine them not realizing it. It maybe have something to do with bureaucracy and who's in charge and who's willing to say something is wrong at the risk of their job and all that. You never know about the internal politics of a particular station, but it's really incredible from our point of view that something with such a huge engineering problem would be allowed to go on and on.
Well, what about the politics of shortwave? I was told by somebody that shortwave radio, in reality, is the wild, wild west. Now, do you think that's true, or is there really some, I guess I want to say, some, does somebody have their arm around it anywhere?
Well, I'm not sure quite how to answer that. Are you talking about worldwide international broadcasting or U.S. broadcasting?
Well, I guess the question applies to all, so but you could divide it up into two sections. That would probably make more sense.
Well, most stations, unless they've just left their transmitters running because they always had them and are not keeping them up, they have some motivation for doing it, and usually it's either political or religious, or maybe on a slightly higher level to keep the country on the international scene by having an international voice. But, and of course, I did not mention commercial reasons, as very little shortwave broadcasting is truly commercial, or if it tries to be, it's not really commercially successful, with a few exceptions.
When we were talking earlier about jamming, Who are the biggest offenders, I guess I want to say, of jamming other countries or doing jamming on shortwave?
Mainly China and Cuba, at least from our point of view, because we're so close to one and the other one is so pervasive. A few other countries do it to keep out contrary views in some repressive countries in Asia, or Ethiopia is another one, unfortunately, which accounts, I don't know if it's cause or effect, but there are an awful lot of clandestine broadcasts going into Ethiopia, and they try to jam them one way or the other. Those don't cause too much problem for us over here, unlike China and Cuba.
Well, I guess my question is what, in specific, I mean, what stations do they jam? I know you said a lot of clandestine stations are on that are being jammed, but like U.S. or stations that we're familiar with.
The Voice of America is jammed by China. Other U.S. government broadcasts are also jammed. Radio Free Asia, jammed heavily by China, not only in Chinese, but other languages spoken in and around that country. That's the worst case. China also jams other Western broadcasts, BBC, for instance. However, usually not in English, but in Chinese or native languages. And Cuba heavily jams Radio Martí. They've never appreciated our letting the exiles set up their own broadcasts back into Cuba. They also jam Radio República, which is the largest private exile broadcaster, and some others that are on WRMI.
So they jam RMI then when that programming is on the air?
Well, unfortunately, they jam WRMI a lot of other times. The station only has one frequency, and it mixes up English and Spanish and exile and non-exile programming. And the Cubans don't seem to want to bother to keep track very well of exactly when they really need a jam and when they don't. And furthermore, in the case of Radio Martí and Radio República, once a frequency needs to be jammed, from their point of view, for a few hours a day, the jammer will still be left on many other hours when other stations are trying to use it, or would be trying to use it if it weren't for the jamming.
Well, maybe we should just dispatch the Air Force to go take out those transmitter sites or something.
Or, as I said recently, Mr. Castro, tear down that wall of radio noise.
There you go.
Well, he really wants better relations with us.
What methods of jamming do they use? What do you normally hear?
Well, it's quite different between Cuba and China. Cuba has a grinding noise, and it's no doubt from multiple transmitter sites, so it all adds up. The grinding also is mixed in with pulsing. Once in a while, you hear some tones as well. Never anything intelligible. And the Chinese, on the other hand, have two quite different kinds of jamming. They're using one is we call a fire drake, which is a continuous music loop of 1 hour, which is very raucous, traditional Chinese music. And if it weren't being used for jamming, you might enjoy it. In fact, you can still enjoy it, and a lot of people probably do, not realizing its nefarious purpose. They use that against certain stations, and against many other stations, they simply put one of their domestic networks, which is already all over the shortwave and medium wave bands, they put that audio onto the jamming transmitters, and often it is offset by a split second, so there's an echo sound, which makes it even more annoying. And that goes on top of the broadcast that's trying to get into China.
That's interesting. I probably have heard the fire drake thing and not realized what it was. But I was told that they have the Chinese have a transmitter down in South America. Now, you'll know all about this, but I may be way off on my story here. This is just what I can remember I've been told. They have a 250,000-watt transmitter somewhere in South America that is targeted to the U.S. I don't know that much about that, although I have found Radio China International on the dial, and you know the S meter would be almost to the all the way to the end. And I've often wondered, where in the world is that transmitter? Is that the one that I'm hearing?
No, I think people are mixed up about this. Now, for 2 hours a day and only 2 hours on one frequency, a transmitter in Brazil does relay China Radio International. It's on 9665 at 01 and 03 UT in Spanish. And it just so happens that the Voice of Russia is trying to use that same frequency to broadcast to us in English, and they collide. But China does not own that transmitter. They're just renting time like they do on many other transmitter sites around the world. The really strong China Radio International frequencies you hear are probably being relayed by Canada. They do a lot of relaying, not only of China, but many other countries. Cuba also relays China. Maybe that's what you were thinking of. It all depends on the scheduling and the frequency, and there's really no secret about these.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. So actually, the now what Canadian shortwave stations operate as these relays?
Oh, it's Sackville, New Brunswick, the main transmitter site of which used to be only for Radio Canada International. But they decided they don't need all that transmitter time for their own purposes, so they rent it out to anyone and everyone. Or so it seems, including China Radio International.
Well, the programming running on Radio China International that runs in English. Now, I tuned in one night and I heard a special on Marco Polo. And it was quite detailed. It was very well done, I might add. You know, I listened to that. I was very, very surprised. I listened to that and I thought, wow. And that thing was really strong. And, of course, as soon as that was over with, the thing went off. And but they did identify themselves as being Radio China International, coming to you from Beijing and all this kind of thing. So I wondered, you know, I wondered, at the strength of that signal, I knew right off the bat I wasn't listening to Beijing because the frequency was way too low. And it was like a ton of bricks coming in. So what you're saying is probably, more than likely, that was Canada then, maybe.
Yes, one can look it up on the various online shortwave scheduling sites. It all depends on the time and frequency. It could have been Canada, it could have been French Guiana, maybe. They also do some relaying, or Cuba, and Albania does as well. But the strongest signals we get here, as a rule, are the ones from Canada.
So is that the Canadian government would allow a Chinese relay? Now those stations, though that particular shortwave you're talking about, is that not a government-owned station?
You mean in Canada?
Right, the one in Sackville.
Well, it's the CBC, which is like a public corporation. I think they would not like to be called government-owned.
Okay, all right, but I recall CBC when I lived in Detroit. There was stations over in Windsor, Canada, that seemed like they were affiliated somehow with CBC. I don't remember which ones they were, but I just remember them coming on and doing news and identifying themselves as CBC.
Probably CBE on 1550. Yes, there's CBC stations, you know, in every city and town in Canada. Currently, RCI is part of CBC. Shortwave service. There have been times in its history when it's been separate, but not at the moment.
Well, I know the Chinese broadcast was rock solid. I mean, it was in there. Now, do they do? Let me ask you this: when they broadcast, are you hearing any Cuba is a good example. I remember when I was a kid listening to Radio Havana, Cuba, and sometimes I've just about rolled on the floor listening to the news. You'll tune in and they'll start doing a news story, and it's so it's so badly done to begin with. it's laughable, but then they'll start adding things in, and does that go on anywhere else other than Radio Havana, Cuba? Do you hear newscasts like that anywhere else?
They're even worse from North Korea, as you might imagine, although not so easy to hear. They're very single-minded and totally divorced from what's going on in the real world. Of course, Cuba has its talking points, which must be mentioned as if they were news every few minutes, such as the five heroes who are unjustly imprisoned in the U.S. And who knows, they may actually be unjustly imprisoned. Trouble is, there are lots of Cubans in Cuba who are unjustly imprisoned, and you never hear about them.
Oh, I just remember hearing it, and this hasn't been very long ago. Tuning in to Havana, and they were doing a news story about President Bush. Okay, now, you may not like Bush, and whoever is listening, they may not be Bush fans, but I'll tell you, when you listen to this, you realized, regardless of how much you were politically aligned in the other direction, that the news story was 90% fabrication. It was just, I mean, it was off the wall. And actually, it was funny to listen to. It was kind of, you know, humorous to me. I was laughing. I couldn't, you know, and it was so bad. They were mispronouncing words and things. It was just real. I don't know. It was something else. And I've wondered, you know, I've not really ever, I don't guess I've ever listened to propaganda. I've never actually tuned in a station and realized that's what I had. But I'm sure you've done this and you're very familiar with it. Now, where would you find North Korea on the dial? And how difficult is it to pick North Korea up?
Well, they don't have any relays, for starters. If you hear it, it's direct from the country. They do have some pretty powerful transmitters. At 13 UT, they are on 9335 and 11710 in English to North America. That's probably when I usually run across them. There are a number of other broadcasts.
Well, I wondered if they were difficult. I mean, you know, how much of an antenna do you need in order to grab the RF coming from there?
Well, reception varies a lot because it's, at least here in Oklahoma it does, because it's a high-latitude path and the propagation conditions change a lot from one day to the next. So you need to keep trying. Some days it'll be good, some days it'll be barely audible. You know, of course, the better the antenna, that always helps, but I wouldn't say it's difficult.
What types of new services, I guess I want to say, new data services and whatnot, are using HF right now that maybe didn't exist 5 years ago? Do you know of any? Are you familiar with them?
Well, I understand there is an email service. I don't know much about it, but I read about it occasionally. That's what you're referring to, or, you know, to reach people in remote areas to somehow hook into the Internet.
Well,
I'm really not familiar much with PSK and all this, these digital modes that the hams are into and the utility stations.
Well, I guess I was primarily referring to utility stations, you know, commercial communications on shortwave or HF that involves newer technology. And I wondered if you were kind of up on that or could explain any of it, because I'm told that there's a lot of it, but, you know, I don't know what it is and I don't know what it sounds like. Some spread spectrum things. Now, I will say this. There was a company here in the United States called Terion, and they paged truck drivers. So the truck driver would have a little receiver in his vehicle that tuned to a local FM station, and that would pipe into their notebook computer. And then as he's traveling across the country, of course, it would require that receiver to go to different stations. But anywhere he was able to get a, you know, a page or something or text message or something like that. Well, they use these little devices. They call them pingers. I had never seen one of these before, but they asked me. They said, "Would you mind putting this at your property at home, and we'll pay you a monthly fee to have it?" I said, "Well, fine." This wasn't very big. It had like an 8-foot whip on this box, and inside it there was a I don't want to say it was spread spectrum, but it would operate on 3 or 4 different frequencies, and if I had the ham rig on, I could hear it. And it was low power, probably 6, 7, 8 watts, and it would move up and down the dial. It was monitoring the local FM that was putting out this Terion, and it was the Terion service, and it was monitoring the way it was going out, like how much was the injection level for the FM, and were the tones going out correctly, and all that. This thing would transmit on HF with 7 or 8 watts, and it would move to different frequencies. It would be on one, and then it would go to the other. And I assume these things are licensed transmitters, or there's some service that, because they were operating these things. But what got me was we were on the telephone with the fellow because he was having some problems with it, and we got in there, we made some adjustments or whatnot, and he said, "Okay, very good." He says, we've got your pinger, we're picking up your pinger in Puerto Rico. It's all digital stuff, you know. I'm thinking, this little box is sitting here putting out 5 or 6 watts. It's jumping up and down all over the HF spectrum. And for the most part, if I hadn't have been exposed to it, I wouldn't even know that a service like that even existed. Have you heard of things like this?
Yeah, I remember hearing about that several years ago, but I haven't heard about it lately, so I don't know if it's still going.
Well, I think they went out of business, and I still have one of their pingers. So we should reverse engineer it to see exactly what's inside of it. What's the most exciting thing about shortwave radio that you catch on the air, or what really makes you light up? You say, wow, you know, get your attention.
Well, it's hard to answer.
You like all of it, so I mean, you're intrigued by the whole thing. So it's, I just didn't know.
If the solar flux ever goes up, I would really be excited. If the higher bands were to open up again, I can vaguely remember how that was when we had sunspot peaks.
I can remember the sunspot activity, especially when I was young. I fooled around with early teens, I fooled around with Citizens Band radio, and I remember Citizens Band during the middle of the day was just useless. I mean, you couldn't talk 2 miles. The thing was just full of noise. And I was told that all of that noise was just massive amounts of people on the air at the same time with the signals coming in from all these different directions. And whether that was the case or whether it was just atmospheric noise, I don't know, but I recall it being a real mess. So you hear a voice just for a second or two, and then it'll be gone.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what it was, if the skip was in.
Well, you know, okay, now I'll tell you what happens. We have a lot of folks listening on the podcasts, and listening to these podcasts, they discover shortwave radio, or they find out about shortwave. And these are novices. These are people who've never fooled around with a shortwave or anything. So my question is, from someone who has made a study of this thing and has as much information available as you do, what would you tell someone how to start, and what should be the first things they start looking for if they really would like to get into the shortwave listening hobby?
Assuming they already have a shortwave radio?
Well, maybe not. Maybe not. No, they have just an iPod and they're listening to this, and they say, "Well, I got to go out and get me a shortwave. I've got to get into this here." So, if you were at that stage, right at the very beginning, where would you go? What kind of receiver would you get? What would you stay away from? And then, how would you set up your listening post? And what would you start listening to?
Well, I would recommend, unless cost is really a factor, not getting the cheapest radio, but go a bit higher in, say, in the $100 range. Get one that has digital readout, so at least you'll know what frequency you're on and be able to go back to it. That's something, a privilege we didn't have back in my early days. But it makes the whole thing a lot easier, and it makes it possible to repeat what you're hearing if you want to hear it again. As you mentioned, I suppose, although Radio Shack has its drawbacks, it's still fairly pervasive in the U.S., so that might be your best place to look for shortwave radio, at least the most convenient place, although there are mail-order houses such as Grove Enterprises and Universal Radio, which have a very good, wide selection of shortwave radios from less expensive to very expensive. And, just string up a wire antenna. You don't need a fancy antenna like a lot of people seem to think. A long wire outside of maybe 50 feet long, something like that. That's what I use most of the time. And start tuning around. And be aware of all the resources on the net where you can find out what you're actually listening to.
So how would you go about finding? Let's say I've got I've picked up a receiver. I've got a 50-foot wire out into a tree, and I've alligator clipped onto the whip antenna, and I'm sitting there, and I'm tuning around, and I hear something, and I know the frequency, and I know about what I'm listening to. Then how would you use the internet to identify that station?
Well, there are three or four, or a few more references of frequency lists, which make massive changes twice a year. There are two major shortwave seasons called the A and the B season. I have these linked on my homepage, as a matter of fact, for convenience. The current season is called A09. So once you have the frequency and the time, and you need to use universal time, because that's the standard, so there's no confusion. You simply look up the list and see what's on the air at that time. And, if you know the language, if you can identify the language, that will further help to narrow down the possibilities of what you're hearing.
Now, when you're listening, of course, how many different languages can you understand?
Well, understanding is one thing. Recognizing or identifying is quite another. So I really couldn't put a number on the languages I think I can recognize just from having heard them and you know, knowing what I'm listening to. The languages I understand to more or less a degree would be Spanish and Portuguese and French. Those are my best, also some German, and I can get by, understand some other Romance languages. I don't get very far in Asian languages.
Well, if a person is trying to learn a foreign language, and they're down the road a ways, can listening to shortwave radio enhance that quite a little bit or increase their understanding of it?
Oh, yes. A number of stations even broadcast language lessons, although it's pretty hard to really follow them unless you have some printed material to go with them. But, you know, once you reach a certain level of proficiency in a language, you can really increase your proficiency by listening carefully to some of the major broadcasts in that language.
When we were talking about folks beginning in shortwave, if they go buy a receiver, and they put, say a 25 to 50 foot run of wire in the yard and then just kind of run it underneath the window. And I mean, do you find the method of alligator clipping onto the if it's a portable alligator clipping right onto the whip antenna, is that an acceptable method of connecting the antenna?
Acceptable, I guess. It's always better if it actually has an antenna jack and the proper plug to plug in directly. It all depends on the radio, and sometimes you're better off not making a direct metal-to-metal connection. You don't want to overload. A lot of these little radios, you can damage, or at least reception will actually get worse if you overload them with too much antenna.
So in other words, you might be better off trying to do a linked connection of some sort, or a... have you ever done that? I mean, have you ever taken and formed a small coil or something and then placed it near the whip or tried to link couple it like that? Have you ever done that?
Yeah, I've played around with that, but really haven't found that it made much difference in my case. It's a lot more convenient just to use the alligator clip.
Of course, now a lot of the radios that are sold, I mean, I think that's something folks ought to keep in mind, and that is if you want to go into the hobby and you want to really do some listening, it's probably advisable to find a shortwave radio, maybe spend a little bit more money, that actually has an external antenna connection on it that you can get onto rather than trying to clip onto the whip antenna. Wouldn't you say that's a...
Oh, yeah. Go that way if you can.
What about grounding? Do you find that does it perform any better for you if you actually ground the chassis of the radio to earth, or does it help in any way that you know of?
Well, I know it's supposed to, theoretically. I'm afraid I haven't done much in that area myself. I do have a high noise level in my neighborhood, so I'm sort of unmotivated to really experiment much with antennas and grounding unless I could get rid of the line noise or whatever is causing it.
Now, see, here's a good example. I would have to say that Glenn Hauser is the leading DX shortwave listener, in the United States of America, at least, and reports and listens to shortwave radio all over the world. And he has a high noise level in his neighborhood, so that's encouraging, because sometimes I'll turn a rig on and I hear all this noise and I think, boy, you know, I wonder what it would be like to live somewhere where there is no noise. And but yet, look at what you accomplish with a high noise level.
Nice of you to call me leading and all that, but as far as the technical end, having a really hot receiver and just the right antennas and grounding and so forth, I'm pretty ordinary.
The person getting into shortwave, though, now, why don't you give a brief description, because we have a lot of new hams that are listening that are new to shortwave. Why don't you kind of describe where to tune? What times of the day would you look for stations? What times of the day are which bands the best?
Well, it depends. There's some basic rules as far as the lower frequencies opening at night and the higher ones in the daytime. And, of course, it all depends whether you're listening to the west or to the east, whether where it's darker or lighter. And it also depends on where we are in the solar cycle, which pretty well damps down everything. So just as an example, if you want to hear stations, if you're in central North America like I am, and you want to hear stations from Asia in the morning, you should go to the lower frequencies, say below 10 megahertz. Of course, and this also differs between winter and summer, because there are great differences in the amount of daylight on any given path, whether you're in the winter or the summer part of the Earth. So all these factors have to be figured in together. If you want to hear Europe, for example, in the morning, you need to listen on the higher frequencies, maybe 15 megahertz. However, reception has been so bad lately because of the depressed solar cycle that you may not be able to hear anything most of the time anyway, even though that's when it theoretically it should be best. While in the evening, if you want to hear Europe, you need to go to the lower frequencies because it's mostly a darkness path. So that's a basic generality.
Well, these are things that someone first starting out would have no idea as to where to begin. They've got a radio, and there's all these bands, you know. They don't know if they need to be on the 31-meter band, the 19-meter band, or where. You know, they haven't any idea.
You may very well turn on your first radio and not hear anything on most of it and figure something's wrong with it, or why should I bother with this? You need to be persistent. You need to try all the bands at all the times of the day till you're familiar with how things work.
That's good advice, because there are some trends, and of course those trends are subject to change. Do you think at this point, from what you remember going, you know, what do you think about this solar low that we're having? No sunspot cycles, and what do you think's going on?
Well, I think this is something that happens periodically, from what I've read. We can only hope that things will eventually pick up. They always seem to eventually, even if not up to the predicted level, or not as high as, say, the previous solar peak. It seems that no one really knows what's going to happen, and all we can do is just wait and see.
Well, you know, with the bands, the sunspot cycle being as low as it is, my son, David, who just got his general ticket for his ham radio general ticket, he's on 17 and 20 meters working all kinds of DX, and I'm like, how is he doing this? You know, because every time I turn the receiver on, I'm not hearing anything. But I guess there's these sporadic openings that take place. Now, you're pretty familiar with propagation. What is it that happens when we are in a solar low, and then all of a sudden you begin to hear stations coming in that are, like, for example, the Canary Islands. You hear the Canary Islands coming in. What is going on when that's happening? Because that's not the normal reflected ionospheric path that you would have during normal sunspot activity.
Well, is it or isn't it? It all depends on the frequency and the time. Maybe it isn't that abnormal. Just because we have zero sunspots doesn't mean there's no propagation at all. And, there can be slight variations, which lead to quite a difference in reception.
Well, I know he's...
There's another type of propagation, sporadic E, which isn't really related to the sunspot cycle, except maybe it gets a little better when the sunspots are lower, and that brings in unexpected openings, although usually not from a really great distance.
Well, I wonder, because he's doing a fine job working DX in a solar minimum, you know, so which should be in, you know, an inspiration to people. But you know, you're in the solar minimum right now, and you're doing shortwave listening and DXing and all that kind of thing. But you're still coming up with a substantial amount of information on World of Radio. I hear you reporting all these different things, and folks are listening. So you're right in that, even though we're in a solar minimum, propagation doesn't just come to a halt.
That's right. That's no excuse for not shortwave listening.
Well, no, I mean, I was wondering, even in a solar low, there's still quite a bit of activity going on, is there not?
Oh, yes.
Well, see, a lot of folks, I think, I get the impression that because we're in the solar minimum, that we're not going to hear anything. The HF bands are going to be completely dead. And you know, and that's just not the case. Went out to the National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB, and we were out. We drove out into the desert, and I had my little handheld Grundig with me, the little $29 job. I'm sure you've seen them; they're a cheap little radio, but I carry it with me because it's so handy. And I tried to tune in QSO, and It wasn't quite there. So I called Al Wiener. I said, you know, flip those other transmitters on. Let's just see what's going on here. Well, there was nothing on 15420, period. But 9330 was coming in like a local AM station on that little radio. So it's so strange, you know, how these things. Of course, you're familiar with it because you deal with it more than I do. You're listening, so you've established already, you know, in your head, when signals should or should not be there, and when something's normal or not normal, or some anomaly is taking place. But I was really impressed with that. I thought that's really incredible, because it was really, really strong. And then I visited Detroit, my hometown. I hadn't been there in 20 years, you know. And I'm standing in the driveway of the house that I grew up in. And I was fortunate enough, this friend of mine that I used to play with as a kid actually bought the old house I lived in. And he gave me a tour. We were talking. What is this shortwave radio business? You're doing some stuff with shortwave. I said, I went and grabbed a little radio, and I started tuning around. And I said, well, here, listen, I'll let you hear what a couple of stations sounds like. And all of a sudden, there's a guy reading this antenna commercial, and it was nice and loud and strong. And then it took me a few seconds. It hit me. It was me. And that was on 9330. So now, you know, I verified the signal on my little Grundig in Detroit, as well as Las Vegas, Nevada, in the desert. So I guess the thing of it is, you just don't know. You don't know when the signal is. And I've seen where the signals are just not there at all. And it's, you know, it's a little frustrating. But it's also fascinating when you get a card from someone on the night that you couldn't hear the station, and you get an email from somebody way off somewhere that's listening, and they're telling you how strong it is and how good it sounds. I'm sure those are the kind of responses you get from World of Radio. Am I correct?
No, to some extent, although I don't offer QSL cards, so I don't get a lot of reports for that purpose. One pertinent thing about this is that there are skip distances which vary depending on the frequency, among other factors. So a higher frequency has a longer single skip before it comes back down than a lower frequency does. So you can be too close to a higher frequency, so it's going over you, or just not propagating at all. That may have been the case with 15 megahertz versus 9 megahertz out in Nevada.
On World of Radio, for folks that are not familiar with the program, why don't you give me a rundown on the format as to what exactly can they expect? They tune in, and what's the flow of the program? Where do you start, and where do you go with it?
Well, lately it's been from A to Z. I compile in text form a lot of info, which is in DX Listening Digest. So basically, I boil down what's in the last few issues of that during the past week, pick out what's most important, and just summarize what needs to be talked about. Sometimes I do it in geographical order by continent. Sometimes I do it in just more or less alphabetical order. And it's just a matter of a convenient way to organize things. the program is almost always one guy talking for half an hour, i.e. me. It would take a lot more of my time to spruce it up with bits of music and so forth, which I feel I just don't have time to do, although in the past I did some of that. So you'll have to be prepared to listen to me talking about all these different subjects one after another. Of course, if you're listening to a recording, you can always stop and go back if you miss something.
The number of people, you get reports in, all the information and all the data that you put out there comes primarily from, is it not, from listeners writing you and reporting things and telling you what they're hearing and whatnot?
That's a major element of it. It isn't the only element. Of course, I include my own personal observations, and shortwave stations publish a lot of info about their own schedules and their changes to their schedules. So I mention that when it's significant. And, of course, there's press about developments relating to broadcasting in various countries.
The program is so detailed. I mean, and I listen to it, and I when I'm listening, I periodically have to stop and make a note because there's so much information there, and I've just been amazed at that. And, of course, if someone is a shortwave listener, and you're getting either started in the hobby, or if you're a ham and you've never tuned into World of Radio, you're in for a real treat, because you find out when you listen, when Glenn is done, you find out, man, there's a whole lot going on out there, a whole lot more than you even imagined. And I just can't imagine keeping up with all of that. You know, that's why I was wondering or asking if you had a lot of reports, you know, if it primarily came in from folks that are shortwave listeners that report to you on a regular basis. I know you do your own monitoring and your own listening, because I hear you commenting on that, writing on that, but I didn't know where all the rest of the news came from, because it seems like you keep up with everything. And how you do it, I don't know. It's absolutely amazing. So,
well, it's a struggle, and it's getting to be more of a struggle just to keep up, just going through all my email and all the websites that I need to check periodically. It really takes up more of my time than I ought to be devoting to this, I'm afraid.
Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about while I've got you on the line, for those that do listen to World of Radio and the regular listeners, as well as ham operators that have never tuned in yet, as well as new folks that are just getting into shortwave, you're basically a listener-supported program. And I would like to encourage people to pull out the checkbook and help finance this thing, because I found that it is in my book, as far as shortwave is concerned, you know, this thing is the most amazing radio show on the air. And you know, I know what I do on QSO is one kind of thing, but what Glenn does is, you know, beats what I'm doing hands down. And if a ham is not listening to this thing, they're really, really missing out. Now, I've got it on my Zune. So every time I plug the Zune in, every time you have a new edition, it just downloads. And I listen to it. If I miss it one week, I hear two episodes the next week. But how are you financed? This is a thing, though, that's a labor of love, and you are doing it primarily by listener support. Is that not correct?
Yes. I do invite people just to send me contributions. If they like, either they can do it by a check in the mail, I give my address in every show, or by PayPal. That's a convenient way to do it. It's all on my website, worldofradio.com. And, I just try to keep going, dipping into my own funds if necessary.
The thing is that, I want to emphasize this to the folks that are listening, that is, this radio program is a milestone, and as an amateur operator, I would really, really hate to see Glenn Hauser go away for any reason at all. You've been doing this for so long. It's so professionally done. The program is outstanding from that standpoint, and it's full of accurate information. It's full of dialogue and even some editorial on his part. I think that if you haven't listened to it, you need to tune in. Now, could you give me a rundown on the stations that you're currently on, or is that going to be too extensive? I mean, we've got I want folks to go to worldofradio.com. That's the website, and you're going to find the schedule up there as to when it airs and on what stations it's on. But I thought you may want to do a rundown here.
Well, I'm on three U.S. shortwave stations, WWCR, WRMI, and WBCQ, several times a week on each of them. So that's the main way to hear it on shortwave, at least in North America and vicinity. I'm also on IRRS in Italy, which transmits from Slovakia, and I understand it has a pretty good signal in Europe. Beyond that, there are quite a few stations which are webcasting only, which carry World of Radio, and the shortwave stations also do webcasts, so lots of options there, and they're all put together in a single schedule that's on my website.
Well, I know it's on iTunes, because I clicked on subscribe, and I get a regular thing now. Go ahead.
I should mention that, yes, that's thanks to World Radio Network in London, which also carries me on satellite and on their internet service, and they provide the podcasting.
That's really one of the handiest ways to listen if you're as busy as most folks are, if you want to keep up with things. The other thing is that on your website, of course, you can download the files directly from worldofradio.com, and you also put out the text files for reading so that you can actually go up there. And what's longer? Is the broadcast longer? It seems like the broadcast doesn't have all the stuff that you write out longhand.
Longhand?
Well, in print. In other words, I download...
Oh, no, basically, the broadcast is a little more than headlines. I just don't have time to go into much detail, so there's a great deal more. I haven't figured out the proportion in DX Listening Digest in text, but these are very large files, which I put out maybe two or three times a week. So if you hear something of interest, you want to know more about it, chances are there is a lot more about it if you look it up in print.
On the podcast... that they get is exactly the same audio that you would get if you were actually listening to one of the shortwave stations,
right?
And that's what I thought, but I didn't know if there was any changes or modifications to that at all. But that's it, basically the same exact thing. Well, I guess the only other thing I'd like to ask you about, and that is. For folks that that are, like I was saying, that are new, getting into shortwave, I guess, what additional tips would you give them as far as, I guess what I'm saying is the hobby itself, shortwave listening as a hobby, what other things could you share with them in terms of unusual stories or unusual things you've heard that that has stuck with you over the years?
Well, one thing that's an anniversary is coming up. There was a famous broadcast that Radio Beijing made right after the Tiananmen Square massacre, which is almost 20 years ago. An announcer actually told what had really happened and paid dearly for it. That was recorded, and it's if you know where to look for it, you can find that. That was certainly a momentous event. There have been a few other occasions like that where something happened that really got coverage that perhaps the authorities didn't want. As for just getting into this, I think we should also mention there's some print information that's easily accessible that you can find and familiarize yourself. There's a magazine called Monitoring Times, which you can find on better newsstands or subscribe to. I write a column for that, and there are many other columns which go into other aspects of radio and shortwave listening. And there's an annual book, a reference book called The World Radio TV Handbook, which has an incredible amount of info about stations, schedules, addresses, what languages they broadcast in, and many other things. Although TV is in the name of it, it's mainly about shortwave radio. So look for those in your library or your bookstore.
Well, I hit Books a Million every month to get my copy of Monitoring Times. I enjoy going in and getting the magazines. Of course, they put out Popcom. No, they don't. That's another publication puts out Popcom and CQ. And Monitoring Times is put out by Bob Grove.
Right.
And it's a wonderful magazine. Matter of fact, I don't want to miss my monthly issue of Monitoring Times because it's just that good. And of course, I catch your article in there. You know, you write quite a little bit that winds up in that magazine, and it's good stuff. Plus, you get to see all the pictures of all the radios and all the different things that that you don't necessarily see on an internet site, you know, all at one point in time. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate what you do. I want to invite everybody. Be sure to tune in and catch World of Radio and go to Glenn's website, which is worldofradio.com, and check it out. You know, download the episodes. If you've got an iPod or a Zune, get set up on either iTunes or Zune or some other podcast service where you can get this thing downloaded and listen to it every week. If you're a ham radio operator, I just can't imagine a ham getting through without listening to World of Radio, because you find out everything in the world that's going on. And how Glenn does it, I don't know, but he does. And it's just really remarkable. I want to thank you so much for coming on. I'm one of your biggest admirers and biggest fans, and I'm really I guess I want to say I'm a regular listener, and I certainly would miss this radio show if it wasn't there. So I also want to encourage folks to participate financially in keeping this thing going. But thank you so much, Glenn. Anything else you'd like to say before we pull the plug?
Well, just thank you, Ted. I really appreciate your inviting me, and I've enjoyed talking to you.
All righty, sir. Thank you.